This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about Stop Cop City and the national epidemic of police violence.
Our guest is Kamau Franklin, founder of Community Movement Builders in Atlanta.
We will also be speaking with the co-author of the recently released book, No Equal Justice, The Legacy of Civil Rights Icon George W. Crockett, Jr.
Our guest is Peter Hammer, director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State Law School. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Less than 2 weeks after Atlanta police fatally shot an environmental activist, officials there held a news conference to announce they're moving forward with plans to build a massive police and firefighter training center. Protesters have dubbed the $90 million Atlanta Public Safety Training Center Cop City. Plans to build a training center have met with opposition from the local community and also from out-of-staters. Trees would be felled, undermining the city's efforts to save its tree canopy and increasing the risk of flooding. Others oppose the center for its practice of, quote, urban warfare and its proximity to poor and majority black neighborhoods. The Atlanta police and fire chiefs claim the center will replace substandard trainings and boost morale. The police department, especially, has had difficulty hiring and retaining officers. The January 31st news conference came nearly 2 weeks after the January 18th police killing of an activist known as Tortuguita, after officials claimed the 26-year-old shot a state trooper. Officers said they fired in self-defense, but protesters questioned the police narrative, noting the lack of body camera footage of the shooting. Joining us to talk about Stop Cop City and the national epidemic of police violence is Kamau Franklin. Kamau is a former practicing attorney from New York, the founder of the national grassroots organization Community Movement Builders, and co-host of the podcast Renegade Culture. Kamau, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You recently wrote in Truthout that the idea of Cop City came after the uprisings in 2020, when the police perpetrated murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and here in Atlanta, Rashad Brooks, began a new call for defunding and or abolishing the police. Kamau, has citizen action put police on the defensive? And if so, to what end?
I think at one point, the police were really on the defensive based on citizen action, based on organizing and activism. I think the 2020 uprisings, both in Atlanta, nationally, and across the world, in terms of like solidarity or support, really started to emphasize the idea that public safety would not get solved by putting more police into communities, and that the tactics and training, ideology, and methodology of the police was a danger to communities and not anything that was stopping crime. But then I think there was a shift that had happened post that, that corporations, that the media, particularly corporate media, and the elected officials and or politicians sort of did a dance and did everything they can to rehabilitate the police to the larger community and try to put the cause of defunding, the cause of abolishing, the cause of public finding alternatives to public safety on the defensive. And so I think we're at a stage where, you know, now there's this resurgence of overt police killings that are happening that are getting attention. But I think we're really in this weird stage where organizers and activists and people in the community who are concerned about police violence are struggling to figure out what are the changes that we can make. At the same time, the police and the authorities are attempting to continually act as if it's a one bad apple thing and try to keep and expand policing, particularly militarized policing, in Atlanta and across the country.
Before the Atlanta City Council approved the Cop City Center in 2021, 17 hours of public comments documented a majority in opposition to the project. Did corporate supporters wield influence during the approval process?
Corporate supporters most definitely wield influence. They were the ones who gave $60 million to make this project happen. Behind the scenes, a lot of the corporations, along with the Atlanta Police Foundation, pushed to make this happen. There's a particular part of Atlanta called Buckhead, which is really where a lot of business headquarters are, where folks who have a lot of money live. They pushed for this to happen. And all of this was done even though Atlanta's mayor, city council, knew that the majority of the city was against having a cop city here.
DeKalb County Commissioner Ted Terry cites a lack of transparency and accountability in the planning process. He says that local officials' claims have not been open to community engagement. Your thoughts on how this is unfolded?
I think he's exactly correct. Since the very beginning, the city of Atlanta refused to do any public hearings. It was only under pressure that they held one public hearing. And at that public hearing, they refused to take questions from the audience. Instead, they had people write things down and they picked and choose what it is that they would respond to. Other than that, they've done nothing whatsoever to talk through their plan, their idea, their strategy. So this has been something that they tried to push through since the very beginning. And again, once it started to leak out, then organizers and activists and community members really tried to fight against this happening because they knew on its face that this was not a call of action that people were hoping for, that after the 2020 uprisings, people were hoping for reform and change, not for more militarized policing.
Kamau, Community Movement Builders, the organization you founded, is a member of Stop Cop City. Please tell us about this initiative.
Well, Stop Cop City is I would call it less of an initiative and more of a movement. So it's a decentralized, autonomous group of organizers, activists, community members, environmentalists, civil rights people, who all, for various reasons, have come out and decided to work together and say that we want to stop Cop City. And so that means people use various tactics, various strategies. Sometimes we check in with each other. Sometimes we obviously support each other's public actions. But it's really an autonomous movement of various actors who are opposed to Cop City. And we are one of the earliest folks to be out there, probably one of the leading Black organizations to take a stand against this. But it's truly a movement that has a large bandwidth in terms of the amount of people who are supporting the idea that we don't want Cop City to happen.
Kamau, how have Atlanta police treated the protesters who've camped out on the proposed site for the center, with an example or two, if you can?
Sure. I think the police have used very violent tactics against the protesters in the forest, as we call them, forest defenders. We should add that since the very beginning of the opposition to Cop City, that at demonstrations in the streets, the police have again used violent tactics and have arrested dozens of protesters. And so the tactics by the police started very early on when we were protesting in the street. But in the forest itself, as you might know by now, over 19 people have been arrested and charged with acts of domestic terrorism. And we should say, particularly for the folks who've been charged in the forest, everyone who was arrested at the time was arrested either in the forest at their camp or in a tree hut. They weren't involved in any activity whatsoever that could be described as domestic terrorism. So we think the criminalization of organizers and activists, particularly the forest defenders, is another tactic by the city, by the police, at this stage by the state government, to stop the movement against Cop City.
Kamau, contempt of cop describes how police officers physically punish civilians when they perceive them to be disobedient or disrespectful. But now, body-worn cameras don't seem to deter the disproportionate use of police force. Why do you think this is, and what are the shortcomings of body-worn cameras?
Well, I think the reason it is because the training, the tactics, the methodology, the ideas of the police remain the same. And those ideas are that they are here to be in control of every situation. They are taught that they are working in criminal neighborhoods with criminals afoot, and that they should be scared of people who they come in contact with. And in some ways, they are to either shoot or command and take command of the situation first before anything bad happens to them. That is the training they get. That is the perspective that they have. And so it is no wonder that just because there is body cameras, that the sort of brutal or physically violent tactics of the police have not relented. Those tactics will continue. And so body cameras have been good in documenting certain interactions between the police and the public. They are the ways in which we found out about a lot of different things that otherwise we would have to rely on the police version of events. So in that sense, they're good, but they're not a tool that's going to prevent police brutality, because the methodology of the police, the militarized posture of the police, is the thing that keeps them doing the things that they do in our communities.
What was the police explanation for using gunfire on January 8th that killed Stop Cop City activist known as Tortuguita? Is self-defense a common reason police give for using lethal force?
It's probably one of the most overwhelming reason, or the most overwhelming reason that they give for using lethal force. It was the threat of obviously bodily harm to themselves. It doesn't matter if that threat turns out to be accurate or not, but at the time of the incident or any incident, the police usually write that they were either being attacked, they were being threatened, they sense a threat, and that seems to justify the use of physical violence, i.e. either shooting, beating, tasering, pepper spraying, whatever it is, against demonstrators and activists. In the forest in that day, the police version of events is that a task force of police that included Atlanta police, DeKalb County police, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, state troopers, SWAT teams, and even to some media reports, the FBI, none of them had body cameras on or turned on. Atlanta is required to have body cameras turned on, but yet there is no body cam imagery of what took place. So we are left with the narrative that the police provided, which is that Tortuguita shot a single shot at them, and then they shot back. From reports we got in the community, folks who heard a burst of gunfire, they did not hear a single shot, a slight pause, and then more shots. They heard a single burst of gunfire. And so we find it hard to believe, highly, highly unlikely, that a person sitting in a cloth tent surrounded by police officers, over a dozen police officers, would shoot a single bullet after being warned to come out of their tent, knowing that basically they would be committing suicide by doing so. So we think this tale that the police are telling is one that fits their own narrative of the forest defenders being violent, but isn't the truth at all. And we need an independent investigation to get to the truth of what happened in the forest that day.
My co-host Heidi Bogosian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Kamau Franklin about Stop Cop City and police violence. Kamau, soon after Tortuguita's murder, five Memphis police officers tortured and murdered Tyre Nichols. What does this say about how police are trained and supervised, and a police culture of systemic violence, especially against people of color?
It says that even after the uprisings we've had in 2020 and before that, even with the extensive training that the police continually get, so the officer who shot and killed Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta received over 2,000 hours of training. Training on de-escalation tactics, training on cultural sensitivity, it made no difference whatsoever. The officers in Memphis were college-educated officers who'd receive hundreds, at least, hours of training, if not more, but they still resorted to acts of violence in terms of using their gun to solve a problem. This is what they are. This is their very mentality in the police department. It is about shooting first and asking questions later. This is not an issue of better training. This is not an issue of the amount of sensitivity training they get or anything of the like. This is an institution which treats citizens in this country as if they are occupied peoples or criminals who need to be taken down as opposed to providing public safety. So we think nothing's going to happen with a militarized police force to change their ways. It's the system of policing itself that needs to be done away with, not anything around training or body cameras, which is going to stop these killings from happening.
Kamau, please tell us about some of the reforms that Community Movement Builders recommends for reforming law enforcement practices in the United States.
We think there has to be the idea that there has to be less contact between the community and the police. So starting there, we think for any traffic stops, for issues around mental health, for issues around houseless people, that the police should not be involved in those whatsoever, that it should be folks who are trained to either give out tickets and to keep it moving, folks who are not armed, not engaging with the public, that only in those ways will we lessen the actual contact between the police and members of the community. Secondly, we think the police need to be demilitarized, and it needs to be community control over how the police operate. Any public safety arm operates in the community. And what we mean by that is, instead of giving these officers militarized equipment and them having ranks and so forth, which makes them feel like a military operation, these night units which go into the community unabated and pick off or stop anybody that they so choose, that all of that has to be ended. Further, that we need to have civilian control over the police, which means that any issue involving the police and people in the community, it is that the people in the neighborhood can have the power to hire, fire, discipline anybody who's supposed to be working on behalf of public safety in the community. We can only demilitarize and give community control over public safety as the valve which is going to solve the issues of police killings and criminal activity in our community.
Kamau, are there any similar initiatives or model practices underway anywhere across the country? And what do you think of the George Floyd Policing Act?
I think there are some initiatives that stop short of doing everything, of course, that we want them to do. But there's initiatives even here in Atlanta. There's a policing alternatives division called PAD, which sends out people from the neighborhood who are not police officers to deal with issues of houselessness or houseless people so that the police are not called on those. Again, it's a relatively speaking small program that's not funded well, but it's these kind of alternatives that need to be propped up and need to be looked at as solutions to criminal activity in our neighborhood by the police. So I don't think the George Floyd Act, again, goes far enough because we're not getting to the root of the issue, which is the militarized nature of the police, the top-down structure, the methodology of using violence and violent tactics against the community as the first thing that they do. Having people who are mostly not part of those communities but are brought into the propaganda system of that they're dealing with basically a criminal element no matter where they look, and that their first response is to gain control of the community. Unless, again, we dig deep and solve that problem, no legislative initiative is going to solve it because they are just going to be Band-Aids on a system that is rotten to its core.
And you've answered this next question in several ways, but what do you say to critics who say that the campaign of defunding the police is unrealistic and hurts those who advocate for it?
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily unrealistic as in if we stick to the old ideas that either the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which never has real power to discipline the police, or body cameras, which again don't deal with the methodology of what's happening, making certain holds or chokehold illegal doesn't stop the police from engaging in certain activities. So the idea that we can sort of reform our way out of this with legislative reform that doesn't get to the root of the issue is really unrealistic on itself, right? And so the idea is that the Black community in particular must continue to endure not only the police killings that take place, but today the day-to-day violence that happens based on the police activities, the over-arrest, the stop and frisk, the harassment. Once folks are arrested, the judicial system, which gives higher sentences, the prison is filled, overpopulated with Black and brown folks in these prisons based on the very work of the police on the street. And so unless we're looking to solve those real problems, we're going to be stuck with this system of small reforms, and then we're going to have uprisings every 2 years because it's not going to solve the problem.
Kamau, can you offer any words of hope as we witness the public torture and execution of people of color at the hands of the police?
Well, less words of hope, more words of resistance, that unless we as a larger community in the United States decide to attack this problem from a different angle in a different way, we're going to be stuck with what we have. But if we do decide, if we really do decide to look at how policing operates and to go a different way, we could do a lot to solve a lot of the issues that we have. So I think it's really about organizing in the community. It's about getting folks to understand what's happening. It's about creating an alternative to how the police operate. It's about challenging public officials. It's about challenging corporations. And I think only in that way, through people power, can we create the difference that we want.
Kamau, how can our listeners follow your own excellent work in resistance?
But they can follow us, you know, through social media channels. Community Movement Builders is our handle. And they can also follow us on our webpage, communitymovementbuilders.org.
Kamau, thank you so much for your history of community activism and for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Professor Peter Hammer is the director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University Law School and has long been a strong advocate for shining a light on the intersectionality of race, class, power, and the law. He has published scores of articles and books covering such critical issues as the Flint water crisis, the Detroit Future Cities program, the City of Detroit bankruptcy, healthcare, education, racism, and capitalism, among others. What brings us here today is that he and his colleague, Professor Emeritus Edward Littlejohn, recently wrote a critically acclaimed book, No Equal Justice, The Legacy of Civil Rights Icon George W. Crockett, Jr., just released in 2022. This book tells the amazing story of George Crockett and his trailblazing life. He was the grandson of a slave and the son of a carpenter. Crockett became the only black graduate of the University of Michigan Law School in 1934, the first black man to work as a staff attorney for the United Auto Workers in the 1940s, the first black law partner in the first integrated law firm in the country in the 1950s, one of the first black men to be elected as a judge on Detroit's criminal court in the 1960s, and the oldest African American ever elected to the U.S. Congress in 1980. He was also, along with Ernie Goodman and Maurice Sugar, one of the founders of the National Lawyers Guild in the 1930s, the first integrated bar association in the country, in which he played a critical role during the civil rights movement of the 60s, including the creation of the NLG Committee to Assist Southern Lawyers. Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
We are so excited to hear about the amazing work you did on this book in collaboration with esteemed Professor Emeritus Edward Littlejohn, and to share with our listeners some of the highlights of George Crockett's life, and to understand just how pertinent his life story is to all of us at this critical historical moment. To start off, tell us a little bit about the origin of this book and about your co-author, Ed Littlejohn. How did you get involved in writing such an important and timely historical biography?
Yeah, so Ed Littlejohn is one of our emeritus professors at Wayne State Law School. And Ed really started this project in the early 1990s. So this book has a long pedigree. Which was great because he could interview Judge Crockett, who was still with us then, and his former law partner, Ernie Goodman. So Ed did a lot of original research, got a lot of the interviews. When Judge Crockett passed, he left Ed a lot of his private papers, so we had access to many things other people didn't. But the project got eclipsed with other things. So about 5 years ago, Ed said, do you want to help me finish the book? And it was about halfway done at that point. And we rolled up our sleeves and got to work, and the book is now finally out there in the world.
Well, Peter, your book introduces us to George Crockett with these words, and I quote, "Two key principles drove Crockett's life. First was an unshakable commitment to racial justice, an unapologetic anti-racist agenda. The second, paradoxically, was a belief in the power of the law and the Constitution, that is, the United States' real but unrealized Constitution," unquote. What do these words mean, and how do they resonate with today's legal, political, and constitutional reality?
Yeah, so great question. And I want to underline the kind of notion of the paradox. So Crockett was born in 1909 in Jacksonville, Florida, in the deep Jim Crow South, right? So he understood racism, and that easily explains why he spent his whole life fighting against racism. But somebody who was suffering under legally sanctioned racism to have such a belief in the power of law is interesting and paradoxical. But it wasn't any constitution. It wasn't any law. He had a very sort of specific theory that only black judges, right, or other people who had experienced oppression could really lead to the realization of the potential of the guarantees in the Constitution. So it wasn't sort of white judges that were going to do the heavy lifting. It was black judges and others that were really going to be transforming social relations. And I think we can immediately see how that's relevant today. As well as the fact that he strongly believed that the life experience of the judges were critical to their work. And that's something that the right has eschewed and has this sort of fanciful world that you can be a judge in a vacuum.
Peter, in your book with Professor Littlejohn, you tell the wonderful story, and it's not so wonderful, but the way you tell it is wonderful, about how between the 1940s and 1950s, Crockett played an extraordinary role in first fighting against the horrors of the McCarthyist era and Smith Act prosecutions for which he himself was imprisoned. Second, being among those progressive UAW lawyers who were purged by Walter Reuther at the height of the Red Scare in this country. And third, ultimately, being one of the founding partners of the first racially integrated law firm in the country, Goodman, Crockett, Eden, and Robb. Tell us a little more about the historical importance of George Crockett's role and its significance to what is going on in this country today.
Yeah, and anybody who just did those things in his life would have had a great life. What's really amazing about Crockett is from the 1930s to the 1990s, 6 decades, he was doing significant, cutting-edge, important work. But if you kind of deconstruct the sequence that you just gave us, you sort of start, he's at the UAW in the 1940s and is purged in 1947. And he wasn't purged alone. He was purged with Maurice Sugar, who was purged with Ernie Goodman. And he then goes in 1948 and represents the leading members of the Communist Party who are being criminally charged, not for what they did, but for what they thought. And that was in United States versus Dennis. And his reward for that, not only being blacklisted and probably at that point imagining he's ruining his career, all the lawyers were held in criminal contempt for zealously representing their clients. So he was facing disbarment. He was facing criminal charges, and he gets back to Detroit. Right, but Goodman and Sugar and Crockett had a lifelong bond. Right, you sort of easily see how that leads to the formation of Goodman, Crockett, Eden, and Robb in 1951, and then they have to take on the entire a Cold War because no other lawyers in the city of Detroit would be representing people charged as being communists. So throughout the 1950s, they're taking case after case. They're representing people in front of the House on American Activities a committee that had come to Detroit in 1952. And they won those cases, right? This little law firm in Detroit was making landmark cases, and by the end of the decade, and this is not just their work, this is sort of a return of national sanity, most of the bad law had been reversed, right? So we're entering the 1950s in awful shape. We're leaving the 1950s at least, while tattered, the Constitution still being intact. And if you think about why that's relevant today, I think that we're going to be facing, you know, similar threats of repression and political targeting and scapegoating that they were in the 1950s. So reading the story sort of like a playbook of learning from our elders about how to get ready for that period and what those fights might look like. But something that a lot of people don't know, and this links back to the purge from the UAW, is the intellectual legacy and void created by the Cold War. Right, whether it was in academics or this in union, whether it's politics, any creative thinking about alternative economic structures was really squelched. So we're living today in a world where we don't have a very active economic imagination about other forms of economic relationships, and all of that is really outside of the perceived mainstream political discourse in this country, and that's a legacy we can trace directly back to the McCarthy era.
Well, Peter, this is so important for our listeners to understand, so thank you for that. In 1964, Crockett and Goodman submitted a report for the National Lawyers Guild Convention titled The Legal Revolution, Challenge to the Legal Profession, in which they lambasted the American Bar Association for its passive complicity in the perpetuation of a fundamentally racist legal system, while the ABA professed rhetorical support for the goal of equality, it ignored the undeniable reality that, quote, due process and equal justice does not exist in most sections of the southern states, unquote. And they go on to say, quote, it is impossible to obtain justice in most southern courts, and the only means presently available to the Negro people is by organized protest and the use of economic and other pressures, until white lawyers and judges are committed to a policy of enforcing federal constitutional rights in their courts, it is hypocritical to urge the Negroes to curtail their demonstrations and to rely on judicial proceedings to secure their rights, unquote. Can you please comment on the relevance of this statement to our present-day reckoning with policing our system of justice or injustice in the United States?
Yeah, so I'm sure all your listeners are going directly to kind of Black Lives Matter protests and these admonishments by folks to be peaceful and not to destroy any property. And I'll get there in my answer, right? And that's sort of the analog between telling people they have no legal recourse and then criticizing them for protesting on the streets. And there's a just basic sociological hydrology that injustices create grievances where people have legitimate claims. And when these claims go unaddressed, these grievances are going to boil over, right? They are going to get to the streets. They are going to result in protests. And we saw that in the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. And there's a wonderful memo that we uncovered going back to the Michigan Six cases, where the federal government had arrested all the top leadership of the Michigan Communist Party. And it's not having an author attributed, but I think it's pretty clear that it was written by Goodman and Crockett, where they outline this kind of legal theory that you have to make openings inside the legal system and let the legal change or the social change to happen internally, or you're going to get revolution, or you're going to get violence in the street. So, you know, this was something that not that they were just sort of casually theorizing about. This is something that they were living over decades. And if we think then again where we're at today, you really can't hold police accountable for police brutality. That has not been successful. That creates legitimate grievances. That creates people that have been harmed. And it's not accidental that those people are seeking alternative forms of recourse, that they're protesting in the streets. And that's also some of the important work that the National Lawyers Guild is doing to protect their rights. Because in some respects, the story of Judge Crockett is the story of the National Lawyers Guild. And those who are interested in learning more about the history of the Guild, this is really a wonderful resource for them.
It truly is. And to segue and just go back a minute again to the 60s, during the beginning of that decade, George Crockett, along with Ernie Goodman, was instrumental in creating the 1963 Committee to Assist Southern Lawyers and the 1964 Mississippi Summer Project, which included not only providing direct legal support for people protesting in the streets, but for the first time undertook, for the first time, as I understand it, the use of the federal civil rights laws and going to federal court to bring affirmative civil rights litigation to the federal courts and the first lawsuits to be brought in federal court relying on the 1866 Civil Rights Act. Can you tell us a little more about all of this and, again, how this impacts the current state of politics and law in our country today?
Yeah. So, again, I want to think about synthesizing a little bit of this for your readers. We were talking about Crockett in the 40s at the UAW being purged. We were talking about Crockett in the 1950s fighting the Cold War. Now we're talking about Crockett and Goodman and the Guild. They're all sort of rolled together in Mississippi Summer in Jackson, Mississippi, where Crockett was heading up the office of the Guild there. So I guess, again, this sort of amazing longevity of this life fighting for racial and economic justice. But all good programs have a simple rationale, right? There really were almost no lawyers, black or white, in the South who were willing to take on civil rights cases, right? So the simple idea that the Guild came up with is, why don't we serve a clearinghouse function where we get lawyers from the North willing to come down to the South and provide the legal work that needs to be done to support the infrastructure of the civil rights movement? And they created that whole infrastructure. And the earlier question was asking about the ABA. ABA was an easy target. ABA was going to do nothing, right? They were going to be absolutely no assistance to the civil rights group. But there's an interesting story in the book where the foil is not the ABA, but the NAACP. Right, who was far more conservative in the Cold War and in coming out of the Cold War in the 1960s than the National Lawyers Guild. Interestingly, when the Guild went in, the NAACP did not want them to be the only people on the ground, right? So the presence of the Guild actually goaded the NAACP to do almost an identical program that they were doing to bring more lawyers to support the civil rights movement. But the Guild lawyers were often more strategic in the trenches, right, and were willing to take the cases that the NAACP was not, because they were not safe cases with clean plaintiffs that were going to have landmark holdings, right? They were doing the street fighting of the civil rights campaign. And some of that was saying, if somebody is arrested, right, and they're in jail, they're marked to be beaten, they're marked to be tortured, they're marked to be killed. So one part of this was to get a bail process, to get people out of there on bail as quickly as they could, but they couldn't let them stay in state court, right? So they went into their legal research, and they were finding interesting legislation that was actually passed in the Reconstruction era, where the state courts were just as dysfunctional, that created greater liberty and ability to take those cases out of state courts that were not going to protect people's rights and move them into federal court, Right, so part of the brilliant kind of legal strategy was to do everything they could to get people out of jail by bonds, and then do everything they could to get them out of state court into federal court, which were marginally better and at least delayed the process and gave people more time. But then you have the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right? So they were then on the vanguard trying to think creatively how to very aggressively apply the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And they were going in bringing what they called these omnibus suits, right? So they'd land in the town, and they wouldn't just sue the library or sue the swimming pool. They would sue the city for every single segregated institution, right? So they're trying to be very creative and forward-leaning about trying to really get the Civil Rights Act to be applied as rapidly and as widely as it could. And sadly, if you just look from a historical perspective, that effort bore less fruit. They were, I think, way overly optimistic about both the speed of cases, the ability of others to delay, and they were not successful in getting the kind of very rapid, widespread desegregation that they were fighting for.
My co-host Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Peter Hammer about his new book about the iconic Detroit judge George Crockett. Peter, I so appreciate your kind words about the National Lawyers Guild. Both Julie and I are longtime and proud members of the Guild. After becoming a judge, Crockett wrote frequently about the fundamental contradictions in U.S. society, pointing out, among other things, first, the inherent racism of U.S. society as reflected in the application of U.S. law. Second, to deny that racism exists throughout our judicial system is to be oblivious to the most fundamental truths about 20th century America. Three, there is no equal justice for Black people today, never has been. And four, I refuse to allow myself to forget the fact that I am a Black judge. Once I do that, I think I'm lost. And that's a quote from Crockett. During the time that he made these observations, Crockett was one of the only Black judges on the Detroit Recorder or Criminal Court, and he was the first ever to become a judge on that court. And he was the first African American ever to become a judge on that court. We now have a bench in Detroit that is predominantly occupied by Black judges. Has this resulted in a criminal legal system that is less racist?
Yeah, I wish there were easy answers. I first just want to pause and have your listeners think about those quotes from Judge Crockett. He could be writing those today after what's happening in Memphis. That sadly, we have this sort of production and reproduction of racial hierarchy where we really have to question in what ways we have and in the many ways we have not made progress. And one of the reasons we're very excited to have this book available is we really think it speaks to the youth of today. As I was talking about before, about the sort of dearth of alternative progressive views because of the Cold War, we don't have a lot of the voices of our elders. If you go back 50 years, you find people speaking like Judge Crockett was speaking now, and people aren't saying those same things. They're not wrestling with the same problems in the same way. So there's a lot of wisdom in this book that is directly applicable to activists on the front lines today, the sort of a segue in. But to ask yourself about the sort of judges in Detroit today, you're back to that theme of times are changing, but a lot remains the same. I will just underscore historical transition. When Judge Crockett was on Recorder's Court was a unique institution in Michigan. It was a court of criminal cases that was coterminous with the boundaries of Detroit. All right, so the elected judges were elected by Detroiters. The jury was jurors from Detroit. So there was much greater chance, both in terms of the election process and the jury selection, for Detroiters when we had a Recorder's Court to actually be represented by Black lawyers in front of Black judges and have a jury of their actual peers. As the sort of white flight took place and the sort of whole region became resegregated, there was a lot of pressure to get rid of Recorder's Court. In the 1990s, they did. So now you're having judges elected at the county level, you're having jurors at the county level who are often not represented like Recorder's Court judges, right? So there's a way in which you might have Black judges, right? But they're sitting in courts that are institutionally less structured to be providing justice for residents of cities like Detroit, right? So there's sort of some structural problems. But I think, again, that it's so easy to, you know, you have Black police officers and they say it's not white or Black, it's blue, right? It's the culture of the law that is critical in perpetuating a lot of these racial inequities. And it's very easy, whether you're a police officer or a judge, to succumb to those cultural institutional actions. And not so much that you're going to be a racist, but you're not going to be a freedom fighter, right? So if you think about Judge Crockett, listen to that last quote that you provided, or one of them, and I'm going to reread it so that you can sort of have that fresh in your mind. Judge Crockett said, "I refuse to allow myself to forget the fact that I am a black judge, right? Once I do that, I think I'm lost." And that goes to back what we said earlier in the interview, that he had a particular theory about judging in which people with marginalized experience who have suffered oppression are the ones that are going to lead to transformation in the law. And I don't see that same spirit in today's judges, right? They may be fine judges, they may be following the rule of the law, but they're not following the trail of Judge Crockett, which is a trail that leads really to transformative types of change.
The analogy you make to the policing culture, it's not black, it's not white, it's blue, I think is very significant in terms of the points you are making here. And I thank you for that. I want to segue back to the beginning of one of the things that we read from your book, which is George Crockett's belief in the law and the Constitution, and that when he referred to the Constitution, he was talking not about the real, but the unrealized Constitution. And I would like your thoughts, and I think our listeners would like to hear your thoughts on, are we any closer to realizing the Constitution that George Crockett envisioned and lived his life fighting for?
Yeah. No, and you know, history has so many twists and turns. You know, you had the sort of black backlash against Justice Sotomayor when she talked about a wise Latina jurist, right? That's very consistent with Crockett's theory of judging, which says that she would know things because of her life experience that her white colleagues would not. And we've seen the backlash against that. We have this kind of pretense that we have judges that are only calling balls and strikes. So the composition of the selection process is critical. But I want to say sort of two themes, and they're a little in tension with each other. You need freedom fighters, right? So if you don't have people like Crockett, if you don't have kind of the freedom fighters of today actually pushing the envelope of the law will not change, right? And Crockett did that as a lawyer, right? Crockett was receptive to those opportunities as a judge. So you need to have that kind of principled courage, that sort of, as we said before, that kind of deep, deep commitment to racial justice and that anti-racist agenda. But that's not enough, right? What you look back at Crockett is you also saw that at that historical period of the late 1960s, when he's becoming a judge, he also started to get the tailwinds of the war in court. Right. So he was a judge and he was a lawyer in his final years at a time when the law was opening up opportunities for change. And you kind of think about the civil rights lawyers in the late 1960s through the 1970s is really testing the boundaries, being aggressive, being optimistic about how far they could transform institutions through the use of the newly enacted of legislation of the 1960s. And then you have a sea change, right? You have Reagan elected in 1980. You have the Federal Society come along. You have various sets of ideological litmus tests. And the very composition of the court is beginning to change and sort of close a number of those doors that had been opened previously and limit the scope of the change that law could actually take place. And I think about the namesake of our center, Judge Damon J. Keith, who started his career sort of like a surfer riding those high waves and then having to switch from writing very aggressive of majority opinions into writing a very sort of effective dissents, but they're still dissents. They're not creating law. So if I think about, you know, if Crockett was alive today, he would have the Roberts Court, right, which is not even the Roberts Courts anymore. It's even worse than it was when it was just the Roberts Court. And so I think lawyers today, if they're just being pragmatic, have to really appreciate the ways in which the constitutional structure did not evolve in ways that Crockett was fighting his whole life for, and in fact, in the last number of decades, has devolved in ways that create even greater obstacles for progressive lawyers and judges now. And what Crockett would say, that doesn't mean that you don't fight. It may change how you fight.
That is so true, and we certainly have an uphill battle today given the right-wing courts, particularly the Supreme Court, but the lower courts, many of the lower courts as well. It's so important for the history of progressive and revolutionary lawyering to be documented and taught to young lawyers. Are there other books or writings that you would recommend, and how can our listeners follow your important work?
Yeah, so I think, let me just say a little bit about what we're trying to do at the Key Center. And at the Key Center, we've said from the beginning that we view that structural spatial racism is our generation's primary civil rights challenge. And all of our work is trying to develop an analysis of what that looks like in concert with members of community, and then apply that analysis to the issues that are relevant for today, whether that's emergency management and financial emergencies, whether that's water shutoffs or tax foreclosures, or the Flint water crisis, or the state of public schools. And so if people are sort of wanting to think about what that part of the current fight looks like, you know, I've written a number of articles that sort of detail parts of that struggle. And what we've tried to do is look for opportunities to create what I call artifacts, where we can be engaged in an ongoing legal dispute, but at the same time create an artifact that is really doing radical truth-telling, and then to publish those artifacts in slightly edited form for educational purposes and for scholarly purposes. So we did that in the context of the Flint water crisis, where I submitted testimony to the Michigan Civil Rights Commission that was looking at that from a perspective of strategic structural racism. We did that in the bankruptcy, where I did an analysis through a lens of spatial structural racism of the economic report that was done to ostensibly certify that the bankruptcy plan of adjustment was reasonable and feasible. So you can find those artifacts if you're just looking at work that I've done. But we also are active in the community. We have the Detroit Equity Action Lab, or the DEAL program, that is doing leadership development to train the next generation of leaders in Detroit to deconstruct structural racism and to end structural racism. And if your listeners are interested in that work, they can go to DetroitEquity.org. But, you know, we're just on one front of the war. I mean, there's great lawyers, there's great scholars throughout the country that are doing important work, and we're just happy to ally with them.
Peter, thank you so much for continuing to shed light on this and so many other important aspects of U.S. society, racism, economics, and the law. And thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed myself.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. The sick and the hungry unable, protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Hardening crimes is a part of the times, and it's rough for some people to live. Disease can move fast, but it don't have to last. It is now the nation's turn for all to be concerned. We can be freer still. It is the people's will. And bring back the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. People. Power for the people. Power.
people. Pop, pop, pop.